solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Play to Potential, playing is not always very well defined, you know. In that way, you know, spiritual life is like jazz, you know. You master certain notes, but there's a lot of improvisation that's needed, that's necessary, that happens. So one is, you know, to continue to explore and never cease what one's potential is, but also to question the path that one takes. It's important to master a few things, but still leave a sense of openness, a sense of openness for mystery, for the unknown, for improvisation to happen.
Welcome to the 68th Conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman, and I work with leaders and organizations and help them play to their unique potential. The two questions I try and help leaders with are where to go and how to grow. I find that these two questions are quite parallel to the two questions businesses need to ask in the context of their strategy: where to play and how to win. To know more about my leadership advisory work, you can visit playtopotential.com. In this podcast series, we feature conversations from leaders from different walks of life on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. My guest this time is Venerable Tenzin Priyadarshi, who is the President and CEO of Dalai Lama Center of Ethics at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He recently published a book, Running Toward Mystery, where he speaks about his remarkable journey starting from the age of 10, where he decides to run away from his boarding school, taking a train to the end of the line, and then riding a bus wherever it went. It takes him to a monastery that he's been seeing in his dreams from the age of 6. The book then takes us through the series of events that leads him to his current unique role at MIT. While a lot of us may not make the kind of extreme choice that Venerable has made in our respective journeys, I feel there's a lot we can learn from him on leaning into the unknown and exploring the world of possibilities. Without further ado, let's dive into my conversation with Venerable Tenzin Priyadarshi. Venerable, thank you so much for making the time. It's really a privilege to be talking to you at the Play to Potential podcast.
Well, it's a delight. Thank you for having me.
And at the outset, which part of the world are you in as we speak, and how are things at your end?
Well, I'm in the desert mountains outside of Arizona and Southern California border. You know, a little bit of mayhem in neighboring states because of wildfire. But otherwise, it's the relative calm before the storm of elections. So we'll see.
That's true. Venerable, I wanted to spend a bulk of time talking about the book you've recently published, Running Toward Mystery, in a way which chronicles your journey and your choices so far. But at the outset, what caught my attention when I read the book was in the flap of the back of the book, you're described as an innovative thinker, philosopher, educator, and a polymath monk. I was just curious about how you relate to each of these identities. Maybe just to set context, give us a sense of what you do, how you spend time, and a little bit of the why behind what you do.
You know, at the very outset, I should say that, you know, the part of the joy of being a monk is becoming comfortable with identitylessness, you know. So much of my life and the effort ongoing is to not assume additional identities, but to lose whatever that there is. However, in the world that we live in, of course, these labels are useful, but most times they become trappings of different kinds. So, You know, I think by virtue of my dabbling in spiritual life and academia and the world of invention and discoveries, these titles or labels get afforded to me. But I would say, you know, innovative thinker, mostly in the sense that I question things. I maintain a healthy sense of curiosity. I am a fan of tradition, but not bound by it. And I like to think, but I don't like to think mindlessly. It's not a pastime, leisurely exercise. It's a purposeful thinking. And by purposeful thinking, it's again something that is influenced by you know, the Buddhist worldview, which is thinking towards the sense of collective well-being and collective sense of joy and how to nurture a mindset of freedom. So I think that's, you know, that's my sort of world. I think the notion of I'm going to get long-winded in these kinds of answers, so you will have to edit all this stuff.
No worries.
You know, the notion of polymath, I think simply what it signifies is that my interests are not contained in a singular discipline. And there's a clear reason for that from early on, because of my interest in multiple subjects and not being somebody who was dictated by market economy or professional ambitions, I was able to deeply dive into many disciplines. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, I had a sense of aversion to formal education because I thought it was not a very useful way of learning. But when I first came to US and I realized that I could dive into so many things, that my undergrad year, I declared multiple majors and multiple minors because I was a monk. I had nothing else to do. So I just wanted to study. And it just sort of, you know, made me go deeper into things. So that's what I guess, you know, these titles might be useful in terms of labels. Yeah.
Got it. Venerable, I'd love to go back in time. In the book, you talk about leaving your home when you were just 10 and heading out into the unknown, walking out based on a dream or a vision that you saw. And you say that the episode was neither rational nor irrational. It's just that you needed to undertake that journey. Could you speak about this episode and more specifically about this notion of neither being rational nor irrational? What does that mean?
Certainly. I mean, so firstly, you know, it wasn't one dream. It wasn't one episode. It was a set of recurring dreams. And I think it just intensified over the years, which prompted me to run away from the school. I think, you know, the challenge with humans is that we want to find reasons or explanations for all our experiences, right? And the thing is that oftentimes such reasoning happens in the aftermath. You know, my friends in neuroscience tell me that the way a human brain functions is that it takes a decision and then it tries to tell itself of a story of why it took that decision, meaning the neurons mm-hmm. that fire around choices. There's a delay mechanism in terms of when we actually do something versus when the neurons actually fire. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and that's at the microscopic level, what's happening in human behavior in terms of choices and decision making. Now, on a macroscopic thing, again, the idea is that people want to know what was the rationale. Now, I was 10 years old. I cannot tell them that I had thought about it. I cannot tell them that I reasoned with it and so on. But I also know very clearly, even reflecting retrospectively, that it wasn't an irrational, impulsive decision. That there was a sense of conviction that was rooted in a kind of clarity. It wasn't clarity on my terms, but it was a certain kind of clarity that prompted this decision. And so I used it as an example to also encourage individuals to leave some room for non-rational experiences, meaning that we don't need to reduce the set of human experiences into binary mode of rational and irrational. That there are non-rational, and non-rational simply implies that it is yet to be explored. There's no convincing storyline or a narrative around it. And we may never find the right storyline, but it is a class of its own.
And how do you discern that non-rational part? Rational, of course, a lot of formal education is around, you know, making sense within the limitations of the human mind. But how does one discern the non-rational elements in the context of choices?
That's a great question. I think non-rational simply implies that we are pushing the boundaries of reasoning as we know at that particular moment in time. We are pushing the boundaries of the known. So whatever data, whatever knowledge, whatever understanding I have at that time, whatever conditioning that I have at that particular moment in time, that I'm pushing it, not necessarily knowing what the outcome is going to be or where it's going to lead me to. And it may be a complete disconnect between the set of historical experiences that I may have had, meaning that I cannot see a straightforward causation that is leading to this thing. But it also, you know, it's not irrational in the sense that it's not just, you know, a result of an emotional outburst. It's not a result of a whim. It's not a result of, some kind of reactive mindset.
Got it. Yeah. And maybe changing the lens, wearing the lens of a parent. I have a 10-year-old girl and a 6-year-old son. I'm just curious, how does... while what you did was quite dramatic in the context of what happens in an average household, as a parent, how should we think about, letting children be versus, helping them navigate given our limited worldview? How do you think about that?
Well, you know, as a disclaimer, I'm not a parent. Sure. So these are, I would say, not personally tested advice, but many of my students, both in academia and in spiritual settings, are parents and grandparents, and we have had long conversations around it. So first thing is that, you know, of course, in my own experience, the decision I took and the impact it had on my parents, of course, I don't wish it on any parent. I think, they were completely distraught. In my mind, I knew that there was a gap in the understanding of the worldview and so on. Right. But let's get back to the business of parenting. Right. One is that, being a parent is a privilege in many ways. Raising a life is a privilege. And the idea that you are not just shaping or raising a consciousness, nurturing it in ways, but this idea that when to intervene and when not to intervene, meaning when to get out of the way, is also useful parenting. It's also mindful parenting. Because oftentimes what happens is parents consciously or unconsciously want to live their unfulfilled life, unfulfilled dreams viscerally through their kids. I had this ambition. I could not fulfill it. My son or daughter shall do it. My grandparents had this ambition. They could not fulfill it. The family had this ambition. They could not fulfill it. And it becomes sometimes quite toxic, you know, when we try to live our lives viscerally through the next generation, because we curb the sense of freedom. We do violence to their sense of independence, their sense of determination, and so on. And so I think that's, you know, one of the biggest challenges that I find in the world of parenting. And the second thing, of course, is, you know, just the right kind of guidance. And, in, you know, Asia, including India, is known for helicopter parenting, you know, where parents are constantly hovering around, you know, planning a kid's life until they are married, or even after they're married when they have grandkids and things like that. And I think that's, you know, one of the challenges is to recognize that you know, we can do without that sense of dominance and the world of parenting and the world of relationship. So I think, you know, that's what we need to be mindful of, to be able to recognize a child's dream, a child's own vision, a child's own disposition, knowing when to correct it, but also knowing when to let it be, knowing when to encourage it. You know, it's a rather difficult task, you know, so. But those are the advice that I also give to teachers in formal systems of education. Knowing when to get out of the way is important.
True. Back to your journey, Venerable. You've sort of, when I read the book, the other thing that struck me was just the extent of conviction you've had in your journey, despite a lot of external pressure around you. At various points in time, at some point you talk about one of your relatives that comes to talk to you to say, you know, why be a monk when you could be a sahib or a politician or a professor? You're throwing away every gift you'd inherited. How have you thought about having the conviction in leaning into mystery at various points in time?
It has been a struggle of in its own rights. You know, I mean, it's not that, you know, all these things have been a smooth journey. And I think, you know, and I cannot say that the conviction hasn't evolved over a period of time. You know, there were days when people would ask me, do you ever doubt your decisions? And I say, I reflect on it every day. You know, meaning that it's not that it is kind of built into my system that this is what it was, sort of thing. I have tried to imagine what my life would have been if I had followed the paths laid out by my parents and so on. And there have been numerous times when my parents and I and extended family have had these conversations. You know, there were times even up until a few years ago when my parents were suggesting that, you know, all the work that I was trying to do in education and humanitarian stuff in India and elsewhere, wouldn't I be better off being a politician to be able to do those things better? And I thought deeply about it, and I talked to a few people, and I realized, no, it requires levels of compromise that I'm not willing to entertain. So there have been different challenges, I would say, you know, but one of the things that that spiritual life has taught me is the idea that you know, to embrace a sense of unpredictability is important, you know, so yeah.
And could you speak?
I also mention it in the book that when my publicist and lit agents and all were suggesting to write a memoir, I said, I'm too young to write my memoir. And secondly, I might change my mind any day.
Coming to your journey, if you had to pick three or four choices that you've made that have significantly impacted your trajectory, you know, if we just pick these two points, you walking away from home when you were 10 towards towards the unknown, and you being at MIT, you know, one would assume, you know, it's difficult to think of a curve that would join these two points, but there is a curve. So are there three or four discrete points in the curve where the choices you made that have significantly shaped your journey thus far?
Yes, I think, you know, besides that, that particular episode of running away, the second episode of, would be, you know, despite of my aversion, agreeing to pursue both, secular studies and religious studies, simultaneously. It was, you know, it was a burden at times. You know, imagine a 12-year-old kid trying to juggle two curriculums, you know, and both in somewhat highly competitive environments. Hmm. But I think when I look back, it gave me a particular set of perspectives that I do find very useful to this day. The third thing I would suggest is the opening to other religious traditions. Mm-hmm. Was very useful. You know, growing up in India, of course, I it was natural to be exposed to so many different traditions, but the keen interest in exploring all of them and not being simply content with what I was learning on my own was very helpful to understand better human nature and how historically and otherwise various philosophical and religious traditions have approached it. And lastly, the thing around the study in the sciences and technology, which is again that making a conscious decision that I did not want to become a professor of Buddhist studies or just become a spiritual teacher in a narrowest sense of the word, or manage a temple or manage a monastery. All those things have perks associated with it. There's a kind of certitude, you know, that you get with being a tenured faculty member or running a monastery and things like that, and every step of the way encountering those opportunities but then deciding that no, it's okay to continue with a degree of uncertainty, so it's managing ambitions to maintain sort of the clarity or purposefulness of things have been a challenge.
Wow. And is it fair to say that the current role that you have at MIT is sort of one of its kind? It's not a, you know, the Dalai Lama Center for Ethics. In a way, you've sort of sculpted the role. It's not a role that existed that you slotted into. Is that a fair observation?
That is correct. I started off at MIT almost 20 years ago, initially as a visiting scholar. I was invited by then the president of MIT, Chuck Vest, who was a wonderful scientist and a wonderful human being. And initially I started off as doing just some experimental work, because I was still a grad student, at that time. And then, they said, well, why don't you become, the Buddhist chaplain to the Institute? And again, it's one of those things that, you know, the word Buddhist chaplain was not a common thing. Mm. I don't know what a chaplain means, so I was like, okay, you know, let's try this as well. So I was a visiting scholar and then I had this role. And then, most of my work was teaching at Sloan and other schools within MIT and working on some joint research stuff. And then, as I have mentioned otherwise elsewhere, that around 2007, after touring a bunch of universities around North America for lectures and speaking engagements, I realized that there was a sheer lack in the study of ethics. meaning it was simply approached as philosophy 101 kind of subject, and strictly sort of in an academic manner that with very little relevance factor. And so I started having this conversation with my colleagues at MIT at that time. And then the financial meltdown happened. And suddenly, you know, the entire world was questioning the ethics of business schools and schools of management and what's happening. And I saw that as the right moment to establish a learning center that would promote and nurture ethical imagination. And so part of the, if you ask again about the innovative stuff, it was to figure out ways of promoting ethical imagination that was not prescriptive in nature, as it had been historically, but highly relevant and highly relevant to disciplines that people were pursuing intellectually, professionally, and otherwise.
Got it. And actually, going back to one of the things you said, Venerable, early in the journey, you speak about straddling two worlds, right? Where, you know, you went to a regular school with other kids, spending more and more time at a Buddhist temple nearby, and so on. One of the things I've discovered in several of my conversations of this podcast and otherwise is sometimes when you have to transition from one orbit to another orbit, a lot of times we take a deep plunge, but very often one has to straddle both these universes, and that comes with a burden, as you said. Could you talk a little bit about just that notion and how it's played out in your life?
Depends what day of the week it is. oftentimes I used to joke with my colleagues that I wake up quite early, around 4 a.m. or so. And between 4 a.m. and 8 a.m., I am immersed in disciplines and literature and tradition that is over 2,500 years old. And by 8:30 a.m., I'm discussing framing of artificial intelligence. So the jump happens quite often in that way. It is a burden in the sense that, over a period of time, of course, there has been increased sense of proficiency. So that allows for this to be done in a seamless manner. That every day and multiple times during the day, I find myself going back and forth between traditions, end time, worldviews, and juggling these things. I think the challenge, one of the biggest struggle, of course, often becomes is the aspect of relevance, you see. Because, if you take, a cosmic view of the world, we are insignificant. We are less than a dot in the ever-expanding universe. And a Buddhist would know that by virtue of their meditation, by virtue of their experiences and so on. But at the same time, a Buddhist also knows the sense of uniqueness of each individual, the uniqueness of time and space that we are in, our role, our responsibilities, our sense of duty, and so on. And so it often becomes an issue of relevance, that from one perspective saying that, is it really relevant? But from another perspective, it is, yes, it does matter. And it matters in these particular ways. And those are the things to think about. People spend too much time bickering about shallow things. But if you are constantly waking up with reflection on mortality and reflection on death, you recognize that a lot of what we engage in, a lot of what we are invested in as individuals, as a society, is irrelevant. But we give meaning to it. We give stories to it. Sometimes those meanings are valid meanings. Other times they're just fabricated stories of sorts. And I think that's the struggle, the joy, that one has to experience.
And as we think about the journey into the unknown, one of the other questions that often come up is, what should my compass be? You know, when I'm sort of navigating into a forest without Google Maps, without streets and highways, what, in your experience, what's given you the compass as at various points in time?
A healthy sense of curiosity is important. Spiritual terrain is not new. It has been traversed by many. Even the historical Buddha, when people tried to make him a unique figure in history, even he came out and said, I'm not the first Buddha and I won't certainly be the last one. So spiritual terrain is very rich, historically and otherwise. It's traversed by many. And it's an issue of finding individuals who have traversed it skillfully. But at the same time, one is also carving one's own path, So it's kind of guidance by proximity in certain ways. But you have to maintain the sense of curiosity. You have to maintain the sense of healthy questioning, to sort of progress in the thing. You see, oftentimes what happens is that, we're not looking for a compass to find direction. We're looking for a compass to gain validation, to gain a sense of certitude. You see, oftentimes in spiritual conversations, people are simply looking for an affirmation. I have a path. Just tell me that I'm on the right path. That's not how it's supposed to be, because that's the false sense of knowing, the false sense of certitude that we are looking for. So the compass needs to be driven by that. And secondly, that, it does not need, it has become quite fashionable, for example, these days to talk about balance of spiritual life in a manner that it simply becomes a mode of performance enhancement in worldly life. Because I'm a spiritual individual, look at me, how successful I am materially. That I have accomplished all this thing because of my spiritual leanings. That is an incorrect portrayal of things. Because your priorities do change. Your worldview does change. Your sense of what to pursue, what not to pursue, changes dramatically. And so we should not sort of, look into those kinds of modes in terms of the compass of certitude, that if I'm doing this right, I'm going to excel in a way excellence is defined in the worldly sense.
I think a related point you make, Venerable, is, you talk about the fact that, a lot of times the spiritual practice is turned into a life hack by a lot of people. you say, what's my ROI on this? If I meditate for 20 minutes, I get out of it. I found that quite provoking. And you go on to say that what's needed more urgently is the attention to the motivation, the discipline, and the sense of purpose that creates a nest for practice that'll ultimately determine the outcome. Could you talk a little bit more about the mindset with which we need to pursue this journey, the spiritual journey?
That's a useful thing and a good thing that you have picked up on. There are varying set of opinions of why one should pursue a spiritual life, why any individual should pursue a spiritual life. But fundamentally, if you look in Indic tradition, the goal of spiritual life was oftentimes soteriological, meaning it was for the purpose of freedom. It was for the purpose of liberation. And freedom from what? Freedom from suffering, freedom from misery, which for the most part, most traditions would say was self-created, right? That there would be other causes of misery, but most of our miserable experiences are self-created misery. When we utilize spirituality or spiritual discipline as a life hack, we become good at managing suffering. Okay? Meaning that just like we have become comfortable with everything else that has encouraged the sense of complacency, we become good at managing suffering to the point that we are actually content just managing it. There is no desire to free ourselves from it because our identity is too tied in this sense of management of misery and management of being in this world. See? And that I find is the biggest challenge, is where people have sort of, especially in the contemporary landscape of things, where people have tried to, focus on particular skill sets of spiritual life, emotional regulation or, sleep regulation or regulation of mindsets to be able to break through and have a very productive day and things of that nature. In those kinds of settings, we forget to ask the fundamental questions. We are not really shifting our worldview on a grand scale of things. And then other times we sort of give in to the oxymorons of why do something. For example, I cannot tell you how many times I've been approached to help design apps for meditation. And especially when I was taking a year at Stanford, almost, I would say, 2 to 3 proposals a week of various forms. To the point that after first 3 months, I had to tell my assistant, any inquiry on apps, find out what they really want, and then we can have this conversation. Right? But you take an example, simple thing. What is your intention? Well, my intention is for people to meditate more. Well, why do you want to create an app for them to meditate more? Well, I want to create this app so that it can facilitate people to meditate more. Why? Because tradition is obscure. Tradition is not accessible. People come up with all these kinds of reasons and rationales, very different from the other mindset, which is you need to make effort to find the right teacher, to find the right fit of the tradition and so on. But here's the challenge is that then you ask them, well, what are your measures for success for this app? Because you see, in order for the app to be successful, right, the user must give up using the app after a while. Right? Meaning that if I'm designing a mindfulness or meditation app that is simply increasing the behavioral tendencies of dependency and codependency, then it kills, again, one of the fundamentals of meditation practices. See, that you don't become dependent on the method. But if my model for creating a successful technology is that user keeps coming back to the same thing. And I find, many novel ways to keep bringing users back to the same thing. I'm promoting addiction. Now I can, again, come up with all the brilliant narrative I want to come around meditation and freedom and happiness. But fundamentally, what I'm creating and promoting is addiction, just of different sorts. So these are the things that I think people need to deeply think about when we talk about, life hacks and, coaching and, designing apps and things like that, that the spiritual world is very rich. Of course, we can find things and tools from these rich traditions that are highly relevant in the lives that we live. The fundamental issue is, what's the purpose? And that is something that we need to deeply reflect on. Because again, one of the things we have to recognize is that unless and until we learn to give up metrics by which we are measuring our conventional life, those metrics fundamentally do not work in the spiritual landscape. And if we bring it in there, again, we do violence to the spiritual landscape.
That's a profound point. And in a lot of ways, I guess we are wired to be driven by metrics, you know, like we say, we move, we monitor what we measure. So clearly there's a, very interesting. And on a related note, Venerable, you talk about this notion of deliberate practice. In one of the pages, you say, you know, practice is a container, and if done right, everything we do, every waking moment is held inside that container, and every act, whether it's folding a cloth or picking up a teapot, is worth doing carefully, correctly, with patience and attention. Can you talk a little bit about this notion of deliberate practice, just in the way we approach our life and every moment?
You see, ordinary perspectives on spiritual practice is that it is something radically different from our day-to-day life. You know, that's why we have designated places of worship. That's why we have designated time, celebrating festivities around religious calendar, observing fasts, going to retreats and things of that nature. To the point almost that we have created the sense that these are sort of, you know, the sacred or the holy moments or days that I need to be more mindful of my religious or spiritual orientation. But otherwise, you know, it's life up for grabs. We just do whatever we feel like doing, you know. And you know, it's a challenge to recognize that spiritual discipline is something that ought to permeate every aspect of our life, from perception to decision-making to choices to every interaction, right? And initially, it takes certain kinds of effort, you see, and that's where the deliberation part comes in, that it is a discipline. And the more proficiency you gain in this discipline, then it becomes an effortless act, meaning then you're not thinking that you need to set aside time for spiritual practice. You may still, you know, enjoy meditating for 1 hour or 3 hours or 9 hours a day, but, you know, you're not sort of tied to that particular idea that meditation only means that, or religious or spiritual practice only means that. So there's this sense of effortlessness that we develop over a period of time. Now, a lot of times what happens is people just want to begin with effortlessness, let's say, which is sometimes not very useful, because we are creatures of habit. And when we simply start with effortlessness, the old habits are not gone. You see, the old habits simply creep their way into this effortless attitude towards things, right? So what the discipline does is allows us to refine some of these old patterns, these old habitual patterns, to refine them and identify which one is going to be helpful in the kind of lifestyle that I wish to live versus not. So, and then what happens is that one develops something like an aesthetics of practice. An aesthetics of practice is where even ordinary things and ordinary tasks reveal a tremendous sense of beauty in it. It's almost like observing the joy in a child's eye when they're observing something new for the first time. And you can almost gaze into their eyes and you can see the neural synapses happening. It's like, yes, she knows that the toe moves this particular way. She knows that if she touches the dog is going to do this. She knows if she smells the flower, this is a thing. You know, the beauty of that learning. You see? And what happens is that, you know, we romanticize the idea of being lifelong learners, you see? But we have let go of this joy of learning, this joy of curiosity, you see. And so the deliberateness of spiritual practice allows us to maintain, see, this aesthetics around experiencing the joy of practice, so that observation, so that no two sunsets are alike, no two humans are alike, no two plants are alike, that you're able to sort of relish in the beauty of diversity that nature has to offer.
Fascinating. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. A couple of thoughts here. One is a point that came up in my conversation with BJ Fogg of Stanford,
the author of the book Tiny Habits, who studied the process of habit formation for several decades now. He speaks about three things: motivation, ability, and prompt in the context of building a new habit. He says that till we get the ability to do something, our motivation levels can be really low. So the idea is to keep the habit so small that even with limited ability and motivation, we're able to get it done and slowly build from it. If this is of interest, tune into my conversation with BJ Fogg, who's written the book Tiny Habits, or James Clear, who's written the book Atomic Habits, who speaks to a similar theme. Another guest, Rich Fernandez, CEO of Search Inside Yourself, a Google incubated company, spoke about this notion of an integrated practice.
When people think about meditation, they think about having to do exactly what I just said, which is set aside, you know, X block of time and, you know, sit in a certain way and close your eyes and protect this space for formal practice. But there's also a way to practice mindfulness and meditation in an integrated way. So, for example, as you move through the course of your day, integrate it into your day. Between meetings, you know, if you need to walk to the restroom, make that a walking meditation. I'm actually serious about that, right? Become aware of your body as it moves through space between your office and the restroom. Become aware of your footfall. Become aware of, you know, the felt sense of your body. How are you feeling actually in that moment? Or take the opportunity to focus on breath, or this being in India, this podcast, you know, if you have a mantra that you're, you know, that you're familiar with or particularly like, use that. And I say mantra, and there's often a religious component to that. But here, what I'm referring to is really finding an object of your attention to train your attention upon it. Whether it be mantra or breath or walking or sensation, you can really do this throughout the course of your day. I was driving to work today and I was focusing on my breath, not so much so that I wasn't able to drive, but when there was a red light, when I was stopped in traffic, in and out for three breaths, I noticed my breath.
Rather than treating mindfulness and spirituality as something separate, I guess we all have an opportunity to weave it into the small things in our life. If you're deriving value from the podcast, a couple of quick requests. One, do consider rating and reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts. A, it'll help listeners discover our content. And B, it'll help us get better speakers who look at these kinds of metrics when they make a decision on whether to appear on a podcast. Second, do consider paying it forward to Antarang Foundation, a nonprofit that I work with closely, that does some great work with urban youth who come from challenging backgrounds and helps them access the world of opportunity. You can know more at the Pay It Forward section at playtopotential.com. Now, let's get back to a conversation with Venerable Tenzin Priyadarshi.
Moving to a slightly different topic, Venerable, one of the things that came up in my very first conversation, it was with the tennis legend Vijay Amritraj, who used to play tennis for India, was one of the top-ranked players in Asia, and so on. And, you know, he quoted Thurgood Marshall, and he said he did what he could with what he had. And the reason I bring it up is at some place in the book, you talk about, you know, Fuji Guruji. And he says, and you talk a little bit about how do you use your distinctiveness to bring about change in the world, right? And you... in one of the paragraphs you say, I'm not convinced that the most effective way that I can move the world towards peace is by drumming and chanting. It seems more logical to work on diplomacy and negotiation between hostile parties or designing policies to circumvent conflict. But then you go on to say that people like Fuji Guruji did exactly that and impacted many people, including you. So how do you pick a path that's true to your distinctiveness and make a difference in the world? How do you think about that question?
I think it is something that I'm still exploring, in all honesty. The thing is, you know, one is, of course, the understanding of behavioral disposition. That, you know, so the notion that are we tied by it, or is that just the starting point? Meaning that, of course, all my choices and decisions are somehow tied to my behavioral dispositions, my mental dispositions, so to speak. And over a period of time, I might want to do certain things. And I say, okay, it's a skill set that I can acquire. You see, to expand my disposition in that regard. Mm-hmm. But that only happens, in a certain point in time, meaning you bring up tennis legend. I have an amateurish interest in tennis. Mm-hmm. However, if I start playing tennis today, and no matter how much effort I put into it, I might become really good. But the disposition is not such at this stage that I'll become another, Rafael Nadal or anybody else, you see. Meaning that you recognize that certain disposition need to be groomed at a particular point in an individual's life, you see. And then you have to figure out that whether that is the fit, the right fit for that individual, you see. So I'm not suggesting that everybody can do, anybody can do everything. Sort of thing, right? And the current culture, I think we give certain kinds of false promises by portraying that, that you can do whatever you set your mind to. It's a good start, It's a good start to begin with that sense of openness. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, one has to, constantly recognize, am I limited by my dispositions, or am I letting it grow, or am I expanding those kinds of dispositions? So in terms of Fuji Guruji, the thing is, this is the part of mystery sometimes. You see, you never know, what could have happened during particular interactions that individuals engaged in, you see, at that particular moment in time, and how it impacted somebody else. Meaning that a deep gaze or a silence at times has been more valuable and proven to be more effective than long speeches and dialogues. So it's just a matter of who's in front of you. If we lived in a world where people could decipher recitation practices and the sound of drum, that they could experience a sense of awakening, it would be wonderful. It would be less words, more drumming. But we live in a world where there's constant commotion. There are all kinds of noises. And in that noise, sometimes the drum is useful, and sometimes a kind word, an encouraging speech, those things are useful. Meaning that, Buddha was never a big fan of one size fits all, meaning, one of the things that you would recognize about Buddhism is that it's a highly inconsistent tradition. Internally, because Buddha was never keen on consistency, Buddha was keen on being effective. Humans are not consistent. So when you're trying to work with humans, you come up with skillful means, relevant techniques that applies to each individual.
And when you use the term consistent in the context of human beings, could you say more?
Yeah, I mean, in the sense that, what might, help shape thinking or behavior of one individual, right, may not be effective on another person. And so one of the things is, as a teacher, as a facilitator, is to recognize what is the unique disposition that each individual comes to you with, right? And, even in Buddha's lifetime, there were learned Brahmins who showed up and who were tied to their own tradition and their knowledge and so on. And there were people who were just farmers and soldiers and warriors, and they came with a different worldview. And Buddha, appealed to each one of them in different ways.
So. And on a related point, in the book, you talk about the notion that teachers don't come to us on our terms. That got me thinking. And you go on to say, as long as we insist that the lesson plan has to proceed along our expectations, nothing a teacher says or does will make a difference. Can you talk to us about the wisdom in these lines?
Well, it's basically to shatter our expectations that we have of ourselves and that we have of the world around us. This consumer mindset has taken over to the point that even learning has become a form. What am I going to get out of it? Even day before yesterday, I had to do a media interview and they asked me, what are the takeaways from your book? And I said, what's the point of takeaways? Why do you think that there should be takeaways? Why don't you think that there should be just letting go, that if you read the book, you might actually shed some traits. You might actually, let go and dissolve some of your tendencies rather than takeaways. You see, so this idea of consumer mindset is it's so deeply ingrained, in us, that we have to recognize that the rules of engagement in spiritual life are quite different. So this is what happens is, we seek a spiritual teacher, but we have expectations. We have expectations from what the teacher should appear as, what the teacher should speak in the language, and so on and so forth. When we follow a book, when we read a book, it's the same thing. You see, meaning that all we are doing is looking for validation and affirmation. And this is the difference between having a spiritual teacher versus reading a book or watching a video. A book or a video is not going to push your buttons. It's not going to bring to your mind truly what is at stake. You see, because all we do when we read a book is we seek resonance. When we listen to a teacher with expectation, we seek resonance. But we seldom ask, what in me is seeking that resonance? If it's the same unfiltered ego that is seeking resonance and seeking validation, what's the point of even treading spiritual life? What's the point of seeking a teacher? You see, you can constantly just validate your own perspectives on things. So this is the distinction that we have to recognize, that it is not always set lesson plans. It's not that, in 8 weeks or 6 months, you're going to meet the desired goal. You know, it's like when a car salesman in the US, when they're selling you a car and you ask them, what's the mileage? And they say, well, the mileage may vary, depending on the user. You see? And spiritual life is very much like that. The mileage may vary, and each user is unique in that regard.
Very well said. In the book, you also talk about the power of questions. You speak about Nagarjuna and the way he engaged with questions. And you speak about the art of refining the question. And in your journey, you've met several gurus at various points in time. If you reflected on some of the questions that have fundamentally shaped who you are and the choices you've made and, impacted your journey, are there questions that stand out? Or even a broader question is, what have you learned about the art of crafting and refining a good question?
It has become, I would say, deeply ingrained in my method of pondering, in my method of looking at things, in my method of studying things, and so on. It has also prompted the sense of questions that ought to be more essential and more relevant with time. But it has also developed the sense that I may not find the answer right this moment and to be okay with it. That asking a question does not imply that I'll have the answer and I'll have the answer right now and it will be an answer that I like or it'll be an answer that I appreciate at this moment. So that's in a broader context. In terms of particular questions, of course, there's a whole chapter in the book entitled, Is There Joy in Your Religion? That question to me was very profound, given the experience, given how many of us find ways to be miserable in religious life, find ways to simply manifest a sense of misery in spiritual life, not recognizing that the very function of spiritual life or religious life is freedom. And if we continue to be miserable, if we continue to suffer, then we should ask, is this the right path? Am I doing it in the right manner or not? Is it? The other part in terms of refinement of question that I have found very valuable is questioning my own narrative. That, you know, we humans are very good at rationalizing. The more educated we are, better we become at rationalizing. And we have a tendency to be able to rationalize pretty much anything to our own advantage, to explain it to ourselves. And we live in a time where people are used to grand narratives and fabricating grand narratives. But the idea whether there is any sincerity in it, whether there's a sense of honesty in it, those are the things that, again, my teachers have effectively taught me in this mode of inquiry, because religious literature is filled with narratives. And oftentimes the mindset becomes that these are narratives, stories given by holy individuals, so we should not question it. Nagarjuna shows that everything can be questioned. In fact, that if we simply take something at face value, it's a fall. It's a fall in terms of not being able to utilize the sharpness of human faculties. But it's a very important thing, you know, to recognize. And these days, for example, you know, not these days, it has been going on for some time. But if you look at social narratives, you know, Wall Street narratives, Silicon Valley narratives, political narratives, They are all deeply held narratives, but seldom are they questioned with a sense of radical honesty.
Could you give us internally. An example when you talk about the narrative in Silicon Valley? What do you have in mind?
Well, you know, simple narrative that anything that I invent or create is going to change the world for better. How do we know? I say, if we scale up things, it's going to make the world better. How do we know? Progress is good. How do we know? Meaning that, again, those are narratives that are closely held, deeply held. We don't question it. Okay? But we utilize those narratives to convince ourselves of things. And I think it does damage.
The other element you talk about in the book, page 153, you say, you quote, "A teacher may see your potential in ways that you can't see yourself, and may recognize conditions that are ripe for a change and strike a note that you didn't realize you were ready to hear." I'm curious about how you think about teachers unlocking the potential of the other person that the other person can't see yet. What's been your experience with this?
I think, you know, sometimes, you know, we all have blind spots, you know, and sometimes things that are so close to us or we have held so closely, our belief systems, our mental dispositions, hurdles, obstacles, that they fall in blind spot. And sometimes we just need another thoughtful individual to be able to see them and point out that, you know, that's hazardous. You're continuing to do this. You're not looking at it. That's hazardous. And I think, you know, we should look at obstacles in that particular manner, that when a teacher points out something, you know, it is precisely that. The second thing is, you know, the trappings in the sense, again, that we may get trapped in a particular storyline or a particular narrative of who we are, what are life's purposes, and so on, you know, and we don't need religious upbringing to have that, you know, that's deeply sort of tied into our human nature in some way. And sometimes simply help by pointing to the idea of, is that all you are? Is that the purpose that really drives you? Or sometimes even asking a simple question like, are you happy? Do you feel a sense of freedom? Have you been kind today? You know, simple things of that nature can trigger a kind of reflection, a kind of thinking that I think would be rather useful. And that's the joy of teachers, which is that it's they say things, so they point to things at the right moment, at the right time. And sometimes they have tremendous patience. They need to point to things several times before we can see our blind spot. You know, that's just how this whole discipline is in some ways.
And in that context, in your journey, have there been one or two instances of people pointing you towards something or asking a question and you realizing the value of that several years later?
Oh, yes. Many, many such incidents. Many, many such incidents. One I mentioned, of course, is the story of my very dear Japanese monk teacher, Reverend Sasaki. Okay. And the conversation with him, the way he lived his life, that at times were very puzzling to me, and not by the book, and which made me recognize whose book, whose book is it that we want to live by, Buddha gave guidelines, but are those guidelines still useful if they are simply fabricating more ego rather than dismantling the ego? Those are the things that years later, you come to recognize. You're lucky if there is an instant recognition of certain shortfalls. It's literally like the light bulb going on. But sometimes the light bulbs take time because you have to go through those experiences. Because, at times, even if the light bulbs go on, meaning you have that insight, it's not that you take ownership of the insight. You know, the insight is not embedded in your mind stream. It doesn't change anything. And it's years later that that insight might push you in certain ways that it changes things. So there are many things like that. Mother Teresa, a simple questioning of, you have read a lot about compassion, you have meditated on compassion, how about manifesting it?
Wow.
Simple thing. But very to the point, it was there. But it was a lesson that has changed my entire perspective on how I approach life altogether.
So, wow. Another theme I wanted to understand from you, Venerable, is this notion of building self-awareness. How do you think about the notion of self-awareness, and how do we as human beings widen our self-awareness and reduce our blind spots? What are some of the things that you would like to share with us in that context?
I think first thing is to recognize that self-awareness is not a religious enterprise. It's a fundamentally, as I've mentioned in the book as well, that all humans are contemplatives by nature. You don't need to have a religious or a spiritual orientation to be that, to do that. And so when we speak of self-awareness, it's a simple desire to better understand our own selves, to better understand our own mental dispositions, behavioral dispositions, and starting with that. And then you build this idea of self-awareness in a manner that deeply informs you, about your own biases, about your own emotional landscapes, about your own chains and fetters that are not allowing you to grow. Then next level, the self-awareness informs you about relational awareness, meaning how do you relate to one another? Because we are social creatures, but there are ways of unhealthy relationships and there are ways of healthy relationships. So, And if we don't explore this sense of self-awareness, then we are tied into this narrative of just being consumers. We never look beyond transactional relationships. We may label it as loving relationship and caring relationship, but what is actually driving it is simple sense of transactions. What can this person do for me? I am willing to do this for this person, but what can this person give in return? And so this idea that can we ever think beyond that? Because if we cannot think beyond that, then we are not fulfilling, you see, the aspect of human evolution. How do you even continue having transactional relationship with nature at large by destroying the ecosystem? Because unless and until we understand the beauty of non-transactional relationships, which is rooted in this expansive idea of self-awareness, we are trapped. We are curbing our own growth. It's like a self-sabotage. So I don't see a choice. You see, either you pursue self-awareness or you self-sabotage. There's nothing in the middle.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. Talking about self-awareness, I had an opportunity to speak to Tasha Urich, one of the leading thinkers and researchers in the area of self-awareness.
The reason I call it the meta skill, and this is really important, is that particularly in the workplace, our self-awareness is going to set the upper limit for our success. In other words, you know, think about the best communicator you know, or the best leader you know, or the person who is just the most effective on a long-term basis. They're only as successful as they are self-aware. Because if we're not able to see ourselves clearly, we can't come from a place of values-based behavior. We can't question our assumptions. We can't identify how we're impacting others and change our approach if we need to. So I really see it as kind of the foundational skill, not just to be successful at work, but really to be someone who lives a meaningful, successful, enjoyable life.
She speaks about two types of self-awareness. Internal self-awareness, which is about reflection, mindfulness, and other things we do on our own. The other is external self-awareness, which she says is often orthogonal to what we gather through the internal self-awareness. Do tune into my conversation with Tasha Urich, or look up the curated playlist on self-awareness if this is of interest. You could go to playtopotential.com and find these resources. Now, let's get back to my conversation with Venerable Tenzin Priyadarshi.
And how does, I guess you could talk for hours and days about how we do it, but for somebody who's trying to pursue self-awareness, one of the pieces I'm beginning to become aware of is that there are two parts to it. One is about reflecting and understanding yourself better. And the other is also there's an element of gathering feedback from the world around you and opening up blind spots. How do you think about widening the self-awareness?
That's a great question. First thing is, yes, feedback mechanism is useful, but seek feedback from people whom you trust. Don't seek feedback from people that are simply flattering in nature. Or people are just sort of giving you blind compliments in some ways. That's not a feedback. That's just flattery. See? So having a group of trusted individuals around you, and there's a whole notion of spiritual friendship that I refer to in the book, with this idea of virtuous friends. You see, meaning that these may not necessarily be people that you want to watch a movie with, seek to do entertaining things, but these are individuals that you might want to do a nature walk with or have a conversation with. So having those circles of friends is important. The second thing is that when I say that you have to take inventory of already what's there in the mind's landscape, meaning your emotional dispositions, your behavioral dispositions, and so on, recognizing them is just the beginning of things. You recognize them, and then you have to understand which one of these are actually conducive to my sense of well-being. Because what oftentimes happens is, you know, if we deeply believe that anger is what empowers me and therefore it is good for my well-being, we never let go of anger. In fact, we find every opportunity we get to manifest the sense of rage, to manifest the sense of anger. So there's this deep, you know, kind of inquiry that goes as to, is it truly conducive to my sense of well-being and well-being of people around me? If not, how do I begin reducing it or substituting it with some other framework, with some other value, some other emotional state that I believe would be much more useful? That's it. And then you start embarking on little experiments to do that. You see? And little experiments are helpful. You know, as I said, that, you know, when we used to run, you know, programs for business schools right after the financial meltdown, you know, nobody in the audience would raise their hand and say, you know, I'm not a kind human being. Everybody believes they're the kindest people on the planet, right? But when you start to sort of go into this mode of inquiry, when was the last time you enacted kindness? Towards whom? What's the frequency with which you manifest kindness? You see, so those are sort of practical experiments by which we can sort of start moving in those particular kinds of directions. Bias is a big thing today. You see, how we perceive the other. You see? And there's, you know, a lot of cultural conditioning, religious conditioning that goes around it. You know, but even for a moment to say, you know, what if I was in their shoe? What if my religion was different? What if my caste was different? What if my economic status, financial status was different? So these are the things that you fundamentally sort of bring in to your sphere of awareness to start moving things around. You never become comfortable. You never become complacent.
Got it. Moving to something that's here and now, COVID-19, that's sort of gripping the world. In one of, as I was researching for this conversation, in one of the conversations, you use the term, you know, COVID-19 at some level is a timeout that Mother Nature has given human beings. And we've been all sent to our rooms to have a think about how we're leading our lives. And I thought that's such a profound way of framing what's going on. How should we as human beings learn from COVID-19?
You know, again, there are two ways around it. One way is to say there's a profound learning that can happen in this. We have learned, for better or worse, to disrupt our lives. Meaning, you know, things like we took for granted around work, family, education, all that is disrupted. So one thing is basically to say, okay, are there any new lessons that have been learned in this thing? Let's see. Do I begin to question that, you know, the old habits or the old mechanisms by which I was operating, are they still useful? Yeah, sort of thing. And if that's the orientation, then I think our learning is going to be rich. But if the disposition is such that, oh, this was a painful experience, let's go back to the old normal. Again, old normal was no better. It was as miserable. In fact, not more miserable. But it was a familiar sense of misery. So we are comfortable with it. So that those are the things that I think you know, people need to learn from COVID-19. You know, deeply recognize the sense of interconnectedness, the sense of interdependence that a pandemic teaches you, you see, that we don't wish to learn otherwise. The importance of a sense of solitude rather than loneliness as an outburst of the busy life that we live, you see. Recognizing how important deep human engagements are, you see. You know, rather than just being connected on social media and so on. I mean, they all have utilitarian functions, right? But these are the things that I think we need to think about. And most importantly, embracing uncertainty. You can never be fully prepared for your life.
Wow. Okay?
And that's the biggest assumption that we make.
Mm-hmm. And as you see the world grappling with COVID-19 and some of the narratives you see in terms of how people are dealing with it, how people are talking about how others should deal with it, do you see one or two elements missing in the way you see, the way you're processing it?
Every time there's a natural calamity, for a moment you see a sense of hopefulness in despair. And the hopefulness is that people show more empathy. And you hope that that empathy is going to have a long-lasting effect, that will change people's mind, where they will begin to see the beauty of being empathetic towards each other. And that's one thing that I'm beginning to feel, you know, I shouldn't say sad about, but in a sense that why can't humans be more empathetic towards one another? Say, there are a lot of positive stories around COVID of, you know, nature coming back in more than one ways. You hear about extraordinary stories of care, of sharing, of compassion. But at the same time, you know, even wearing a mask has become a polarized political statement. And those are the things that is reflective of the world that we live in, society at large, which is that amidst this chaos of information and misinformation and so on, how do we reclaim, you know, the fundamental sense of being human? How do we reclaim the fundamental sense that, you know, we need to create a new kind of global tribe, and it needs to be rooted in a sense of empathy, in a sense of compassion. And if that's something that we can learn from this pandemic, it'll be a worthwhile lesson. And also the sense of solitude, I think, is very, very important.
Yeah. Got it. And as we wrap up, Venerable, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. you've had such a extraordinary journey. What's the wisdom you want to leave the listeners with to help us play to our unique potential, given all that you've experienced?
I think it's a very apt title. It could have been... a title of a spiritual book. Play to potential. Playing is not always very well defined. You know, in that way, you know, spiritual life is like jazz. You know, you master certain notes, but there's a lot of improvisation that's needed, that's necessary, that happens. So one is, to continue to explore and never cease what one's potential is, but also to question the path that one takes. It's important to master a few things, but still leave a sense of openness, for mystery, for the unknown, for improvisation to happen.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your time and wisdom, Venerable. Real privilege and an honor to spend time with you.
Thank you so very much. Likewise.
Hope you found the conversation purposeful. Just a couple of things before we wrap up. If you like the content and are deriving value from it, do consider taking a moment and rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. It will help us raise the bar on the profile of guests that we can get onto the podcast. If the podcast made a difference to your life, do consider contributing to Antarang Foundation, a nonprofit that helps young adults from challenging backgrounds play to their unique potential by giving them appropriate life skills and connecting them to the world of employment. You can know more at the Pay It Forward section at playtopotential.com. Thank you for listening, and look forward to having you at the next conversation at the podcast. Bye now.